We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari American, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
Welcome to the RotoWire NBA podcast. It is Thursday, July 6th. Nick Whalen here with DJ Trainer. DJ, you and I have not talked on the pod for a while. I spoke with James a little bit last week, kind of wrapping up what had already happened or what was going to happen over the weekend in free agency. We have a hell of a lot more to talk about now than we did at this point last week. I think maybe the two biggest moves so far in this offseason have actually been trades. You know, with Jimmy Butler going to Minnesota around the draft and Paul George going to OKC late last week. We've had some big signings. Of course, Gordon Hayward, you know, kind of stole most of the headlines over the holiday weekend. But other than that, you know, we've had a lot of minor signings. It hasn't been this massive, massive frenzy. And with Gordon Hayward now officially off to Boston, it kind of feels like we've, you know, reached the apex of free agency and are now kind of on the downslope for these next few days.
Yeah, let's not forget that Steph Curry and Kevin Durant were technically, you know, available to go to other teams, and they decided to stay locked into the Warriors. So when we talk about historic free agent classes, like, we can't forget that a lot of players, like, I think they're actually going to keep getting better and better, because what you have is your best players, like LeBron James, doing like a 2-year deal, but having a player option, which essentially just means, right, you know, one year deal. The NBA, like we've seen this offseason and maybe moving forward, can just flip on its head. And what that's meant, you know, so far is that it's flipped on its Western Conference.
It has. Later in the pod, I want to kind of go through each conference and rank our top eight teams and look at who we think is going to make the playoffs from where it stands now. I did this just kind of on my own while prepping this morning, and I mean, there's 11 teams in the Western Conference that I feel pretty confident about that I think would be playoff teams almost any other year. I mean, you got, you know, like I said, we'll get into this later, but Memphis, Utah, New Orleans, those are teams that are maybe on the outside looking in right now, and that could maybe be as high as a 3 or 4 seed in the Eastern Conference. So yeah, I mean, it was already a Western Conference heavy league, and with Paul George going to OKC, with Jimmy Butler going to Minnesota, you're taking two of the easily the 10 best players in the East, maybe top 5 or 6 best players in the East. You're throwing them into the Western Conference. So that's going to be even crazier. But let's start with Paul George. This broke while we were at a local, I don't even know what league, the Madison Mallards playing. It was a baseball game.
It's technically Northwoods, Wisconsin League.
The Northwoods
made
League.
Up of like B-level college baseball players.
Yeah, it's a college baseball summer league is what it is.
Yes.
So we were at that game, taking in the sights, watching one of our colleagues sing Sweet Home Alabama on the field as part of a promotion. And we check our phones, and all of a sudden Paul George is traded to the Oklahoma City Thunder. You're a Thunder fan. Obviously, you're very happy that you have Paul George, especially because you only had to give up Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis.
Okay, I'm glad that you framed it like that, because all my friends from Oklahoma, everybody in the media, everybody is framing it, you only had to give up this, or you really didn't have to give up a whole lot. But can we please picture it this way? Just please. Is 1 year of Paul George equal to, lesser than, or greater than 3 years of Oladipo and 3 years of Sabonis? Now, I understand that, you know, Paul George is better than Oladipo and Sabonis for one season. But we're talking about six combined seasons of young, up-and-coming, talented NBA players are way, way less than one season of Paul George. I don't really like that everybody's been phrasing it this way, because I don't think that's fair.
Well, it's interesting because, and you can say this with a lot of the moves that have already happened and have happened, especially over the last couple of years, is that in the past, if you paired Russell Westbrook, the reigning MVP, with Paul George, a top 10 player in the NBA, you would probably be the favorite to at least win your conference. And the way things stand now, it's like, okay, maybe OKC could be the four seed. So you kind of have to operate everything on a different scale. It's the same with Houston. You pair Chris Paul with James Harden and a pretty good supporting cast. That Rockets team, if you place them, you know, in every season starting with 2000, like, how many years are they the favorite to come out of the West? You know, at least 50% of them. And you know, you look at that Rockets team and you kind of say, like, yeah, you know, that's fun. Maybe this will be an improvement over last year's team, adding a second ball handler. But nothing that's happened this summer has really had an impact on the Warriors, right? I mean, it's fun to talk about Gordon Hayward in Boston. It was fun to fantasize about Paul George joining the Cavs. Even if that would have happened, nobody was ready to say that the Warriors are significantly challenged. So I think you kind of have to frame it in a different lens, in that I don't know what teams, you know, like, what's the goal if you're the Thunder? You know, like, you're not going to beat the Warriors with the team you had. You probably weren't going to beat the Warriors by keeping Sabonis and Oladipo for the next 3 years, especially with Russ being a free agent next year. It just seems like teams are a little more willing to just throw caution to the wind, because you don't really, there's more room for error, it feels like, because it feels like the result is decided already, that Golden State's going to win. And I think teams are more willing to just say, you know, screw it, let's see if this works. Let's see if we can catch lightning in a bottle and challenge these guys.
So there's a new baseline for how you judge success in
right.
the NBA as of right now. Now, before the Warriors were assembled, and maybe, yeah, you can't even say this about the Miami Heat, because they, you know, they could be taken down. They were taken down, and it seems feasible. But the baseline every year before, basically the last couple years here, was to win a championship. Like, that's how you judge every roster move. That's how you judge GM hiring coaches. Can you win a championship with whatever move you just made? That's not the goal anymore, because you can't. You're just, it's like a big filibuster for the next 4 years, right? And so I think what the baseline is, you have to look at each individual team, and there's a new baseline. It's not championship mm-hmm. anymore. Like, let's not kid ourselves. It's not championship. Maybe it is for LeBron James and company, wherever he's at. But for teams like the Thunder, second smallest market in the NBA, it's retaining Russell Westbrook. It's retaining any sort of superstar that makes you semi-relevant. Bringing in Paul George helps them in that pursuit of saying, hey, we're kind of fooling you into thinking that we're a contender, but really nobody's a contender, so you should still stay here, because we're going to go out and make a couple moves for you, Russell. Please stay here, Russell, because if you leave, then we're the second smallest market in the NBA who has never played a season where they were, you know, considered out of it right from the get-go in a small market, like I said, with, you know, like no glimmer of hope even. And that is just around the corner unless Russell Westbrook stays. So that's the baseline for me. And that has never been a fair or reasonable baseline. It should have always been to win a championship, but it's just not anymore, like you said.
Russell Westbrook's going to be 29 in November. So I think, you know, your initial pitch that 3 years of Oladipo is comparable, at least arguable, you know, to 1 year of Paul George and what that means. Like, if Westbrook was 25 and had a few more years on his deal, I think I would probably agree with you. We would be looking at it differently and seeing this as a short-sighted move, adding a player who's openly told everyone that he wants to go to LA next year. If you're OKC, I think it's worth the 10% chance that this duo works really well, and maybe you go to the Western Conference Finals, you lose, you know, this team's not going to beat Golden State, but you have a season in which Westbrook and George enjoy playing together. Basically, I think this is Sam Presti saying, you know, we'll take that slight chance that Paul George enjoys his time here and maybe doesn't want to re-up on a, you know, 4 year max, but we could get him to sign a 1+1, or something happens in LA and then in the next year and you're kind of slowly able to ease him from that. Like, I'm not saying I think it's going to happen, or, you know, if you're Paul George, you should want to go to OKC, but I think it's worth the chance, because if you ran it back with the same core as last year, which is what OKC was positioned to do, you know, what are we doing here? Like, you're going to get the 7 seed. Westbrook is going to be faced with a pretty difficult decision in the summer, and I don't know what you would have done in that past year to kind of sway Russell Westbrook's mind.
Yeah, I agree with all that, but I really want to key into one thing you said in particular, is that we're all just kind of assuming that Paul George and Russell Westbrook are going to get along, and Russell Westbrook is going to be happy to have Paul George just because he can have somebody within the same realm of his basketball ability. But let's think about this for a second. Did we ever really think that Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant were happy playing together? No. And they even got into arguments. Now, pick any superstar in the whole league. Who is considered maybe the most easy to bend, easiest to flex, maybe one of the nicest? I think you would say Kevin Durant is right up there at that list. Like, just being a nice guy, trying to get along with everybody. I mean, heck, he took a major pay cut to stay with the Warriors. And so if you'll agree with me that Kevin Durant might be one of the most flexible players in the NBA, both on and off the court, then I don't know that we should be so certain that him and Paul George are just going to get along right away. If Kevin Durant could have maybe been one of the best partners Russell Westbrook could have ever asked for.
Yeah, I mean, the personality thing is tough from afar. You know, it's like I don't know who's friends with who seems like they would be friends with someone and might not actually be. But from Durant's perspective, he's easier to fit in because he can shoot. You know, he needs the ball to be peak Kevin Durant, as we saw in the finals, but he can also spot up. Like, that's one of the issues I think with LeBron, is that, well, one, he's so, I wouldn't say hard-headed is the right word, but he's so
stubborn,
ingrained, stubborn, and rightfully so. You know, it's like, you don't want to take the ball out of LeBron's hands by any means, but you can't just throw LeBron on the wing and have him spot up and shoot threes like you can with Kevin Durant.
It's just dumb.
And I think Paul George is closer to Durant in that respect. You know, I don't think he's going to be like, are you saying you could imagine him and Russ going at it because Westbrook is hogging the ball too much? Like, we kind of saw off and on at the end of the Westbrook-Durant pairing.
Yeah, it wasn't even at the end. It was throughout and during, because, I mean, if we want to talk about stubborn players, Russell Westbrook is high at the top. I don't want to, like, call an argument or call a spad, but Russell Westbrook is a hard guy to play with. He has a Kobe Bryant mentality in the final 2 minutes of a game, but doesn't have necessarily the clutch that the Kobe clutch gene. And so from that aspect, that's where Kevin Durant really, really struggled with Russell Westbrook, is that Westbrook plays hero ball when he really shouldn't be jacking threes because he's not a good three-point shooter. And I do wonder, I mean, that happened with the Warriors, right?
Right?
Like, Draymond got mad at Kevin Durant multiple times.
Yeah.
And so it's just something that happens when you put a new team together. I just don't think we should be saying, oh, Russell Westbrook and Paul George, they don't play the same position, so they're going to love each other in Oklahoma City this year, and they're going to love it so much that they're going to want to play 2 years from now. I just, nobody should write off that as a conclusion by any means.
I think it's a bit of a catch-22 for some of these guys, where Paul George has been dying to play with another superstar his whole career. But the caveat to that is when you play with another superstar, that means you inherently give up some touches. So, you know, you would think that he's going in with that mindset where he understands he's going to have to sacrifice a bit, especially when it's Russell Westbrook, you know, arguably the biggest black hole in the league. But part of that last year was, you know, who else on that team would you rather have had taking the shots?
So that's the thing, and that makes a whole lot of sense. Like, Russell just looks around, surveys who's on the court with him, and he's like, heck no, I just need to take any type of shot because it's going to be better. You know, but again, bringing back up Kevin Durant and even James Harden, there were times when he looked around, saw two of the best players in the league and said, I got this. I think I have the best. So I think it'll be off and on. It'll really be a tough process for Westbrook to adjust from last year's style of play to this coming year's style of play. If they want to be good, if they want to be the best Thunder with the best record they could possibly have, we're going to need to see a mentality switch, something we've never seen Westbrook really ever do at any point in his career.
Yeah, I think the one salvageable point, if you're a Thunder fan and you're worried about this, is we have seen Westbrook, you know, make it work, at least with another superstar who's pretty similar to Paul George and Kevin Durant. And like we've touched on, I mean, it wasn't the perfect marriage by any means, but they made it work. They won 55 games four times in 6 years. You know, like, it, as much as it didn't work, it still worked pretty damn well. They went to the finals once. They should have gone probably a couple more times had it not been for injuries. So it's not like we've never seen Russ at least somewhat adapt his game. He's never fully handed it over and just said, I'll be the second guy. And maybe that's a fault of his. But at least he has some experience in this situation. It's not like you're throwing him into something he's never done before.
Yeah. Gordon Hayward?
Gordon Hayward. I wanted to ask you, given what happened on July 4th with the news coming via Chris Haynes early in the day that Hayward had chosen Boston, immediately there's contradictory reports that, you know, not that he wasn't choosing Boston, but he just hadn't decided yet. You know, 6 hours later, we get the Players Tribune piece, which he apparently wrote in about 30 minutes, copy edited, added photos, did the photo shoot, and got it up there. It's pretty clear that he had chosen Boston ahead of time, and he just wanted to announce it on his own terms and probably wanted to discuss it with Utah throughout the day and announce it later. And from what it sounds like, I think Brian Windhorst on the True Hoop pod yesterday essentially said that someone in his inner circle that was not supposed to say anything said something. Chris Haynes got wind of that, did his job, got it out there. My question to you is, what is the right way to handle this situation? Had Gordon Hayward told the Jazz in the afternoon and then just quietly dropped the Players Tribune piece like it seemed was his plan all along, is that the best way he could have done this?
Right. So in simplest terms, Haynes tweeted that out. Hayward's camp went, oh, crap. We wanted to be in charge of this message, and they weren't. And then, you know, they kind of said, no, we haven't made a decision, when they obviously had. And so I think the Hayward camp went about it wrong, to answer your question, right? I think that as soon as Haynes tweeted that out, within 30 minutes, an hour, the piece should have just released on Players Tribune. They shouldn't have done all that backtracking, because really what they did is, like, it's as close as you're going to get to a physical pulling at your heartstrings. Like, oh no, there actually is still hope. Oh right. No, there actually isn't. He just strung us along for six more hours.
Well, the way that it was reported made it sound that reports got out that he was going to Boston, and then Hayward reacted and was like, oh wait, maybe I don't want to go to Boston. When in reality, the decision was always made. Like, there was no waffling the day of.
Right. So the day before, they made an announcement that he was going to release his decision on the Players Tribune, which, if you're going to make an announcement that you're going to do it on the Players Tribune, then you obviously want to craft your message how you want, and you want to be the first one to put it out there, which
makes
sense.
You're also taking several hours to do this.
And let's just be very, very honest that the players are not writing those things. Like, maybe some of them are, but they certainly are getting a heavy edit or something.
I think it's an as-told-to situation.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't go as far as to say that someone else just completely ghostwriting it, but just, I don't think they're sitting down on a laptop and pounding it out.
Right. Go look at any biography at Barnes & Noble. It says, you know, biography of Gordon Hayward with John Wertheim or John Feinstein.
Johnny O'Brien autobiography.
Exactly.
As told to Nick Whalen.
But, you know, there's a lot that goes into that. You know, this is what we do for a living. You can't just, like, say, hey, here it is, and then boom, put it out there. Like, we need to get in contact with an editor. We need to craft the message. We need to check it with a couple of people. And so there was a lot of thought that went into this. It wasn't just, you know, I haven't decided yet. Okay, here we go. Boom, put it out there. I think it was handled wrong. It was obvious he was going to the Celtics, and he should have just kind of confirmed that, came out with the Players Tribune, take your losses in your new home and just kind of run with it. Because in the end, you know, he's going to the Celtics. Nothing changed from that perspective. And Jazz fans are still going to be just as mad at him, regardless of how it's announced.
Yeah, I think the seemingly flaky nature of the decision as it came out on Tuesday probably rubbed it a little bit more in the faces of the Jazz fans, right or wrong. And I don't think Hayward certainly intended it to mean that way, but I think that's the way that Jazz fans reacted, particularly to the belief, whether this is true or not, that the Jazz were not informed ahead of time. And then that's fueled by, like, Trey Lyles tweeted something. He's not even with the Jazz anymore. Rudy Gobert had that snap video. Ricky Rubio tweeted something. So, like, all of a sudden, I think Jazz fans kind of got behind that. And it was like, oh, if Rudy Gobert is thinking this way, it's okay to think this way.
Yeah.
But the Players Tribune is, like, the preferred route now. We saw it with Durant. We saw it with Hayward, the two biggest free agents of the last couple summers. LeBron, you know, the Players Tribune wasn't really the Players Tribune when he made his decision. Was it even around back then?
No, I don't think
it seems
so.
Like he would have used that.
It's
if
fairly
it was.
New.
Yeah, but he basically did that, but with Sports Illustrated. So being able to craft the message the way you want it and kind of give an explanation for your decision, you know, I think that's the point, right? Is so you can write and you can tell people, instead of just them reading a tweet that says Kevin Durant's going to the Warriors, Kevin Durant gets a chance to, you know, kind of explain himself and get out ahead of whatever messages are out there. I don't think that really works, right?
No, and to be fair, we're completely biased as people who write for a living, and you know, like this is what we do, and so we the writers want to write, and they want to be the ones to tell the story. They want to be the ones that craft the story, right? But the big thing here for me is that you can contact a professional writer and he'll do whatever you want. Who was the guy that broke, like, Lee Jenkins, right? Like, you know that LeBron James and his camp read it over multiple times before he announced, or Lee Jenkins announced, that he was going back to Cleveland. And Lee Jenkins was able to write it, and I don't want to take anything away from the Players Tribune, but in an elegant way, exactly like LeBron James wanted it, you throw a little love at Lee Jenkins and SI. And I guess I don't really know, just from logistics, is there any monetary value, like charitable value of the Players Tribune?
See, I was wondering that too yesterday. I'm like, is this just going straight to Jeter? Or, you know, if you're an athlete, if you're in the way that these guys operate, like, wouldn't you say, like, yeah, I'll break it on the Players Tribune if you give me $100,000, you know? Like,
and maybe that is going on. I don't know.
Right. Like, what motivation would you have to go to the Players Tribune for anything other than that?
The only thing I can think of is that they literally have professional athletes, mind you, have such a disdain for the media because they're always right in their face day in, day out, that they want to take away some of their livelihood, like
right,
literally,
well, if you,
their livelihood.
I think the whole goal of the Players Tribune is to get these guys to buy into the buy the players for the players thing. Mm-hmm. And if you buy into that and you're willing to kind of push that agenda, then sure, it seems like a great idea. I just think, I don't care who's writing it, whether it's Lee Jenkins or whether it's the player themselves or their agent or whoever. I think it's just, they try to be sincere, but it's so easy to see through. You know, it's, like, yeah, how many of the, I don't think there's ever been a Players Tribune article that doesn't include the line, I know this is cliche, but, and Gordon Hayward's included that as well. It's like, I really cherish my time in Utah. Like, if you're a Jazz fan and you really wanted Gordon Hayward to stay, you're not going to read that and be like, oh, okay, I understand now. Now, that's fine that he went to Boston. Like, I think it's thoughtful. I think it's better than just not releasing anything at all. But ultimately, I don't believe that the Players Tribune accomplishes the goal of easing whatever tensions are there between player X who leaves fan base X.
And I think there is a place for the Players Tribune. But the nature of what we're dealing with, somebody deciding they want to leave the city, leave the organization, leave that fan base and go to another one, I don't care how you craft that message, whether it's in hieroglyphs or it's a...
That would be something.
Yeah, you know, like thought out Players Tribune in their own words. It doesn't matter. The nature of them physically moving their whole lives away from a fan base, away from a city to a new one, picking somebody else, it's denial, it's rejection. And you can put whatever kind of rhetoric you want on that. It hurts just the same.
We should see if any players want to break their news on RotoWire. Like, who's the lowest level free agent we could possibly reach out to?
Hey, you
Chris
know.
Humphries.
Johnny O'Brien.
He's not a free agent.
He's tearing it up.
He's got a Summer League max deal lined up right
Perk,
now.
Perk, I mean, Perk wants to make a comeback. We will give you a platform to announce
every... we'll give you third headline on the NBA page, Perk. What do you say? So the original question is, what's the best way to do this? If it's not the Players Tribune, if it's not a half-hour special on ESPN, you got, like, what if your favorite player was leaving your favorite team? Let's say you're a Thunder fan. Let's say, I don't know, Kevin Durant leaves your team. How do you want it to be announced if you're a fan?
It doesn't,
too soon for that?
Yeah, it's too soon. I mean, it's funny. I remember where I was when when James Harden got traded away. I was in a friend's apartment. I'll never forget.
Crying on the floor.
Yeah, crying on the floor. I probably won't.
In my underwear.
Yeah. And save for, you know, just on and on and on. And I don't remember how they were broke. The only reason why I remember Kevin Durant's decision was because the photo lives on as a meme forever. Like, if anything's going to come from the Player Tribune,
like a mangrove,
right? He's just out in a vineyard
in the whitest Warriors t-shirt in the
right.
world.
And it's just, so what's funny is that we actually have a physical attachment to these announcements now because of the Players Tribune, because if a Woj drops it, he just tweets it out and that's it. But now we're getting Players Tribune with like some kind of stoic, like looking off into the sunset right. type thing. So that's the only thing. What's the way to do it? I don't care. It doesn't matter because, again, it's the nature of rejection, denial, picking somebody else over somebody else. And so what's the right way? So if I were to do it, and obviously I don't know the ins and outs of being a professional athlete whatsoever, but you listen to guys like Woj, guys like Zach Lowe, and players text them and ask them what's going on. And I think guys like Woj would be more inclined to actually tell them what's going on if they gave them a scoop of their own. You know what I mean? So yeah. If I'm Gordon Hayward, I'm going to tell Woj, hey, I'm going to Boston. And then in a couple years when they're trying to acquire Kevin Love or Kevin Durant or Carmelo or whoever, maybe I shoot Woj a text and ask him what the latest situation is. Because if there's one thing I've learned this free agency is that the players are as far outside of the situation as we are. And that can be seen with all those tweets from the Jazz, Hassan Whiteside tweeting out like, hey, this isn't over yet. So that my only, I'd be very selfish and I think, how can I make this decision give me some kickbacks later on in the future? That's what it is. Assuming that they're not getting some kind of monetary, charitable kickback from going with the Player Tribune, which we don't really know for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to do some digging there. We need to come up with an announcement. It's like a ruse to get in with the Players Tribune. All right, let's talk about the third most important.
I think the ruse is that we'd have to actually play a professional sport.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, they wouldn't just. We need a reason to go to the Players Tribune. Like, what do you guys play? Like, don't worry about it. We play. So we talked about Hayward. We talked about Paul George. This brings us to Nick Young. Swaggy P is now on the Warriors. I've saw a lot of people joking about like, oh, the Warriors are just kind of, they're just doing this to rub it in the face of everyone else. Like, what player with a horrible reputation could we bring in, turn into a productive option and help us win a title? And Swaggy P is now that guy. And he's a really good fit because he shot the ball really well from outside. He's 32 years old, which if you would have told me he was like 24, I wouldn't have believed you, but I would have thought about it. I would have at least done the calculations. He's older than Sean Livingston.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Is that wild?
That is pretty wild. The Warriors have developed such a culture of winning, right? Anybody they add onto that roster, you just shut up. You just shut up and play.
I would say you do the opposite. You like that bench?
Well, you know what's funny?
They're the anti-Spurs. They get the same results as the Spurs, but they don't do it the same way.
You're right, but maybe your play on the court. You just kind of shut up and play however they want you to. Is that better? Or whatever Draymond tells you to do, you do, essentially.
Well, I think it's just an understanding. It's an understanding of excellence and expectations there.
Well, it's get on the gravy boat. Do you want a championship or not?
Well, exactly. We're not bringing you in here unless you buy in. We're handing you a free ring. If you behave and don't mess this up, you're getting yourself a ring. Mm-hmm. And I think they haven't had anybody. Actually, I was going to say they haven't had anyone like Swaggy P yet, but they certainly did in JaVale McGee, and look how that turned out. And I think Swaggy P is on another level as a player. at least than JaVale.
No, or
at least from
really...
where JaVale was going into last year. Like expectations for JaVale were hopefully he stays on the team the entire season and isn't so bad that they have to cut him. Turned out he was pretty productive. Like Swaggy's coming off the best individual season of his career.
He had a stretch last season where he was averaging 30 minutes per game, almost 19 points, shooting 54% from the field, making 4.7 three-pointers per game over a nine-game stretch. This guy adds value. I mean, he was a good snag for them.
On a team that he had like arguably the worst supporting cast in the NBA last year, and now he's going to by far the best supporting cast.
Yeah, no facilitators. Lou Williams was on that team, basically a duplicate of what Nick Young provides for you. You know, they overlapped. Still, Nick Young was able to carve out a nice role. He's a good player. He just so much off the court hoopla gets in the way, but he really is a solid championship piece, if you will. I'll even go as far to say a championship piece. You need guys.
Yeah,
like
this isn't just a novelty signing. You know, I mean, it's fun to joke about because it's him, but he's going to play minutes for them.
Yeah, I mean...
They're going to lose Ian Clark, and he's pretty much going to step into that role, more or less.
Ian Clark, I do wonder if he can basically take Patrick McCaw's minutes. I know everybody's high on McCaw.
I don't think they're really eager to get Patrick McCaw off the court, though.
You think so? I think Nick Young is an immediate upgrade over McCaw.
I think they like McCaw.
I know they
McCaw
like McCaw.
McCaw played 20 minutes in game five of the finals.
I know they like McCaw, but who's better right now? I think Nick Young is better right now.
It depends. I think McCaw's a better defender. He's been in the system. I think they're just going to split time. And okay. You know, neither player is going to see all that much time. I mean, bringing back Iguodala and Livingston, it's not like there's this gaping hole, although they're probably not bringing back Matt Barnes. So Nick Young is probably a little bit better in that three spot. But, I mean, with Golden State, the two and the three are somewhat interchangeable.
It's just so ridiculous that we talk about it, and it doesn't even matter.
No.
You know, it just doesn't matter. A normal team. You know, you would have legitimate questions like, do you play McCaw more? Do you play Young more? But it just doesn't matter on this particular team. Gravy boat to a championship.
Sacramento Kings. What are the Kings doing?
A lot of immediate reaction to that George Hill signing and the subsequent Zach Randolph signing was hatred, disdain. You know, what are you doing?
Classic confusion.
#shock. Classic Kings. I think this is one of the smarter moves they've made over the last few years.
Right. It's not bad.
So
neither of these contracts are bad.
You have one of the youngest rosters in the league, and you bring in two venerable veterans who've seen it all, done it all, great mentors. And by the way, it's not a KG last 2 years of his career mentor. It's, hey, here's what you should do. Let me show you. I'm going on the court right now. I'll beat your ass.
Yeah, exactly.
I will show you on the court. I will lead on the court. And I think that's really valuable for a team that is so, so incredibly young. I don't know why people are hating on the Kings. They're obviously saying there's this weird 3 to 4 filibuster years that it doesn't really matter. So let's bring in some KG vets. Let's progress this young talent. Try to peak in 4 or 5 years. I think bringing in George Hill, bringing in Zach Randolph, honestly, I'm going to say this, is a perfect complement to the roster that they had before those moves. Now, if you want to question the roster that they had before bringing on Hill and before bringing on Randolph, fine. But with what they had, I think it made sense to bring in those two guys.
Well, they lost pretty much their entire backcourt in free agency, and they just didn't really want to bring any of those guys back, and for good reason. So it's not like, you know, they had money to spend. It's not like they're just, you know, plunging themselves into the tax or anything to go for these short-sighted moves. And I think they got George Hill in a pretty good deal. I mean, a lot of people were expecting George Hill to sign, you know, 4 for $100 or at least get those offers, and the market just wasn't there. So getting him for $19 million a year, essentially, for the next 3 years, you know, he's, what, 31 now? So he's 34 at the end of that. That's not terrible. You know, the only thing with George Hill is, for some reason, I don't think of him as being a guy who's always injured, but then you look and he misses a ton of games every year. Mm-hmm. So there's that concern. But at the same time, you talk about, you know, good mentors for De'Aaron Fox. You know, George Hill is not only a well-respected veteran and a smart guy and a guy who's played in multiple systems, including San Antonio, but he's also not – you're not bringing him in to just play over Fox. You know, like it sounds like more than happy – to play mostly off the ball, because you're not playing De'Aaron Fox at the two unless he became a drastically better shooter in the last 3 months that's just not an option. So you're bringing in someone who can simultaneously play alongside him and mentor him without necessarily hindering his development.
You know me, not into rookies, not into prospects that much at all. But the comp that I've been hearing for De'Aaron Fox is John Wall. Do you think that's a fair comparison outside of the obvious Kentucky relation?
Not really. I mean, it's not like horribly inaccurate because Wall struggled as a jump shooter and was super fast in college and had that athleticism.
So that's it. Is that the root of the comparison?
If he didn't go to Kentucky, right. Nobody would have said that.
Exactly.
I always thought that was a little odd. Like John Wall has 4 inches longer arms. He's a better athlete. He came in, you know, much bigger physically than Fox. I think it's unfair to Fox. Like I think he's really good and is a really good prospect and probably would have been a top three pick in a lot of drafts in the past decade. But I mean, John Wall was one of the top 10 prospects, you know, top three point guard prospects of the last 10 or 15 years. You know, like I think it's just John Wall was really, really, really good. De'Aaron Fox isn't quite on that level.
All right, good. I'm glad you cleared that up because I'm always hesitant because I just don't dive into college basketball nearly as much as you do. I think, you know, if you're looking at the playing time, the way it's going to split, it seems reasonable that Fox, Hill, Heald would rotate on those two guard positions. Frank Mason, I mean, the dude was had one of the best college careers ever, right? At Kansas. KG sure. Vet. The guy that I'm going to compare him to maybe is Trey Burke. Coming into the league, would you favor Trey Burke or Frank Mason as somewhat veteran rookies? I know Burke only played a couple years in college.
I mean, Burke was a lottery pick. I think he was kind of the obvious choice.
Yeah, but in a different draft.
Yeah, I mean,
a lottery Trey pick Burke, that was drafted too high.
Yeah, but Trey Burke was going to go in the lottery regardless. He shouldn't have gone as high as he did. You just like players like Frank Mason just don't go in the first round really anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He's 5'11". He's a really good athlete. He's, you know, going to be 23. It's just that just doesn't happen. We're well past the days. James and I always joke about this of the best player in college is just automatically a top three pick. You know, like that's just not the case anymore. If anything, staying in college lower and you lose value, you lose 5 to 10 spots of your value every year you stay.
No, I get that. And that hits close to home with guys like Nigel Hayes, but I'm just wondering, I'm just trying to pinpoint, and I don't want to phrase it like this, but I think our listeners and maybe even you will understand it best. Like who's the Draymond Green of this class who had a very, very good college career, you know, coaches would just rave about them. But for whatever reason, the scouts just aren't into them. And I'm trying to pick out that one talent where they've proven that they're good basketball players, but for some reason, nobody's really believing in their NBA talent. I'm trying to just find that one guy. And I've pinpointed Frank Mason. And I'm just wondering if maybe you think there's another guy that had a very, very good, you know, tangible college career that's not getting a lot of love at the next level.
Well, Mason's not a bad choice. He's just too short. If he was 6'1", I would be with you. He rebounds incredibly well for his size. He's obviously a great passer. He was the Naismith winner. The guy for me is Juwan Evans. He only played 2 years, so he's not quite in the same category as Mason, but he was the most efficient point guard in college basketball last year. And if he was not 6 foot and, you know, he has long arms, which I was kind of surprised he fell to 39, but if he was not 6 foot, we would have been talking about him, you know, as a late lottery pick. So he's kind of a guy for me who, you know, with the Teodosic signing now in LA, probably isn't going to get much of a shot this year, but I think he'll rip up the D League and we'll see more of him down the road. I think a lot of people are on Monte Morris, another point guard from Iowa State, who was basically the most efficient point guard in the history of college basketball for the last couple of years of his career. That should translate well. And then Jordan Bell, if you want like a real Draymond type, he's probably the closest thing. And of course, Golden State bought that pick at 38 from Chicago and got him. And I think they're just going to kind of try to turn him into the second unit version of Draymond.
Well, he's the new JaVale McGee too, right? Or am I?
I mean, Jordan Bell's only like, I think he's a generous 6'8".
Oh, he is. Okay.
So he's much more of a Draymond archetype. I mean, he can't pass like Draymond, but he's arguably the best shot blocker in this class at 6'8", and just has like unbelievable timing, really good athlete, can't really shoot. So, I mean, by no means is he going to step in and be Draymond, but nobody thought Draymond would be Draymond.
How good, and you could tell by his reaction on draft night with his family, how good must it feel for the best team ever in the history of the NBA to go pay $3 million to bring you on their team.
Well, if you're a second round pick, it's great. You do wonder, though, I mean, you could make this case about Jason Tatum with Boston. Would you rather walk into a situation where you're probably going to the finals or the conference finals in year one? If you're a second round pick, I think, yeah, you're just happy to get drafted, and it's great to be in that. But if you're a high lottery pick, part of you, I think, and this is a lot of the reason I believe Josh Jackson's camp didn't want him in Boston, is do you really want to spend your first year or two playing 15, 16 minutes a game off the bench?
100%. And that's, you have to keep your next contract in mind, your second contract in the league. Whoever went to Boston, it was pretty clear it was going to be one of those small forwards, Tatum or Jackson. They traded down, so that could happen. Boston has the best collection of, you know, shooting guard, small forward in the league, and that was before they got Hayward. Now they're just, you know, they have too much talent at that one position, and you can like Tatum as much as you want.
Maybe I will.
Yeah, you could like him as much as you want, but, you know, he's going to have trouble showcasing his talents. I mean, he has to completely surpass Jaylen Brown. And then, by the way, Avery Bradley's still there, Jay Crowder's still there, Gordon Hayward's still there. I mean, there's just not a lot of time to fit in. And so I 100% can see how Josh Jackson would just like, don't pick me, Boston. Please don't pick me. I would love to go to the Suns, play a bunch of minutes with Devin Booker and Marquise Chris, and earn that next contract. I mean, Tatum's going to have trouble doing that, and it's going to be no fault of his own. He could be very, very good for a rookie, and it won't matter because there's just too much legitimate talent ahead of him.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, him and Jaylen Brown have been the two best players at the Utah Summer League. I don't know if you've seen the highlights yet, but Tatum's been incredible. Brown's running the point, which has been a lot of fun to watch. And unfortunately, we're like, Brown maybe plays 20 minutes. It's going to depend on what happens with Crowder. They're going to have to dump one of Crowder, Smart, or Bradley. Rozier might be involved. From what I understand, and if they dump Rozier, they'd still need to make another move to clear up a little more space. Basically, they can't actually sign Hayward until they make one of these moves.
Sign and trade. For essentially
trading
Hayward for Jay Crowder has been talked about. Have we found
it's
any
the same situation?
There?
It's the same situation Houston was in with Chris Paul, where they could have signed Chris Paul as a free agent, but it was honestly beneficial for both sides. Not only did the Clippers ended up getting something back for Paul, and it ended up being a pretty good haul for a guy who's going to be a free agent and is, you know, on the latter end of his prime. And had they just signed him straight out, they would have had to find a home for Ryan Anderson's money. And, you know, basically the Rockets would have had to trouble themselves to give away contracts and probably end up losing an asset or two, which you're attaching to those contracts. So in a lot of ways, it's easier for both sides. And I think we're probably going to see that with Utah. So rather than Boston having to hunt down, you know, a home for an expiring Avery Bradley or Jay Crowder, you know, you can just send them back to Utah and it makes it a little bit cleaner.
Yeah, and that you would think that's still what happened. What would
we'll
happen?
Because
there's still time for it to happen. But they just have too many guys. I didn't even mention Marcus Smart or Terry Rozier in that discussion about having too much shooting guard, small forward talent.
They're going to let Olynyk go. They're going to let Jarebko go. Guys who were not great, but were pretty good rotation players, and for a lot of teams, you know, would probably be kept at decent contracts. And they're afterthoughts. I mean, with Tatum, I think we could end up seeing like a Tracy McGrady type arrives out of him where, I mean, T-Mac was nowhere near as polished as Tatum is right now at this age, but T-Mac averaged 7 points a game, 18 minutes a game as a rookie, 9 points per game is his second year, 15 his third year, and then when he finally went to Orlando in year four and started playing 40 minutes per game, 27 points per game, 7.5 rebounds, 4.5 assists, you know, kind of a Harden type of situation.
Harden is
not that we're going to see Tatum leave Boston, but it's going to be a while conceivably until he really is able to shine unless Gordon Hayward moves for some reason or Jaylen Brown becomes a full-time four. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work out. The nice thing is a lot of these wings are flexible and can play two or three spots.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this before and I'll say it again, is that Boston has too many assets. You can only have five guys on the court at once. They need to start making deals 3-for-1 where they're getting the one.
Yeah. Well, so, and it's not over either because you're getting the Brooklyn pick again next year and your own pick and your own picks going forward. And you have, you know, Yabusele and the other foreign guy coming over this year too. Like it's just it's never ending. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's weird. It's weird to say, but they have too many assets. They need to start packaging these guys for Gordon Hayward level players or better. Like you can like, I mean, Avery Bradley's really, really good. Almost every team in the league would die to have him except the Celtics as they, yep. you know, need to thin out. It's just a weird, weird anomaly in NBA history where they have too many assets. And I think some teams around the league should realize that they have too many assets and almost play hardball with them.
They have been, right? I mean, I think that's what we saw with Minnesota, or not with Chicago, I'm sorry, and mm-hmm. with Indiana. I mean, those right. were the two guys that Boston clearly made plays for and didn't get because they weren't willing to pony up.
And they need to because they have a gluttony of riches, and it's actually devalued what they have, which is crazy to say, but they have so many that you can only... They just have too many, and you need to do 3-for-1 trades, 4-for-1 trades. And the rest of the league has taken note, and they're saying, you got to be kidding me. Like, you're not even, like, assessing what you have right in front of you right now. And they're just saying, you know what? Not even going to deal with it. Not even going to deal with it.
It makes for a lot of salary maneuvering. I think that's kind of an unintended consequence of, like, stacking up asset after asset every year is, you know, guys like Avery Bradley, who are on really nice contracts, each year they lose value, you know? And now we're getting to the point where they might just be giving Avery Bradley away, essentially, to clear room for Gordon Hayward, where you could have just included Avery Bradley in a trade earlier and gotten some value back.
Right.
But then you got to worry about, like, had they packaged Avery Bradley and someone else for Jimmy Butler or whatever earlier in the year, then you have to do other salary maneuvers to fit Gordon Hayward. So it's a lot going on for Boston. It's a lot more complicated than it looks at the surface, but not a bad spot to be in. Like, you know, they'll be okay. I think they'll be just fine. Any other team, there's, 29 other teams would... 28 other teams maybe would take that situation over their current situation.
Yep. I 100% agree. I just think it's weird that they've backed themselves into too good of a situation where it's actually causing them harm. But maybe Danny Ainge has a master plan that we're not privy to.
Do you think the Gordon Hayward signing is overrated?
I think it's overrated, and here's why. I didn't want to go here, but I'm glad you brought it up. Is that you're not saying that you're adding Gordon Hayward and he's a complete new asset, right? Because he has to take somebody's place. What you're saying, or what you should say, is what's the margin of difference between Gordon Hayward and Jay Crowder? Or what's different? What's the margin
cost.
Of difference? The opportunity cost, right, exactly. What's the opportunity cost between Hayward and Avery Bradley? And to be honest with you, between those two guys, it's not a whole lot. It's not a ton, right? And so we can applaud this Gordon Hayward move and say, oh, wow, now they're going to contend and all that. But it's not just they added Gordon Hayward onto the roster. There, you know, you have to look at that margin difference, opportunity cost for having him on and not being able to play Jay Crowder. Right. And I don't know if that margin of difference is something to get excited about.
I think it's sizable. I mean, Gordon Hayward's a very good player. But the way we're talking about him is it's gotten the same fanfare as the Kevin Durant decision. It's Gordon Hayward is a one-time All-Star. He's never made an All-NBA team. He's won one player of the week, which, I mean, if that tells you something, he's only been the best player in his conference for 1 week of his entire career. I just, you know, and of course he's played in the West. And a lot of guys who have multiple All-Star berths, looking at you, Kyle Lowry, you know, if they played in the West, they would be like that. And if Gordon Hayward has spent his career in Boston till now, he'd probably be a four-time All-Star. But the point is, I think we're treating this like they added a top five player in the league, when in reality, they might have added the 17th best player in the league.
Yeah, I agree that there's something to be said about, I forget. What's The Beautiful Mind? Like the most beautiful girl in the room.
Is that a movie?
Yeah, it's a movie. Oh, yeah, I forgot. You're not a movie guy. So I won't get into it too much, right? But if there's a bunch of girls at a party, okay?
I'm listening.
You're immediately going to single out the most attractive one, right? And you're like, wow, she's so beautiful. She's the most...
Well, best personality, yeah.
Best personality at this party. But there could be a party down the street where she is... far and away, not the most prettiest. In fact, she's the least prettiest. But because of your available options, mm-hmm. you are kind of tricked into thinking that she is
right.
super suitable to be your wife.
So
right?
if you're a cute girl, you surround yourself. You never want to be the cutest, or you never want to be the least cute girl.
You never want to
surround yourself with less cute girls to make yourself.
Exactly. We're beating around the bush here. We could use different terminology. But that's what we have in this free agency. And so we said that Kevin Durant and Steph Curry were technically free agents, but it's not really the case. Gordon Hayward is the prettiest girl at a party. That's probably a party that's like a 7 or 8 out of 10, but it's not like...
Yeah, it's a party at like the engineering frat house.
Exactly.
Where it's like, yeah, there's going to be a lot of people there, but you know, what kind of caliber are we talking about? No, I think that's a good way to see it. Like Boston's cap situation worked out where this was the summer they could spend. And unfortunately, you know, they missed Paul George by a year. They missed Jimmy Butler by 2 years. They missed LeBron by a year. And Gordon Hayward was the best option. And it kind of turned into this love fest of, like, we kind of forgot that Gordon Hayward isn't a franchise-changing player. So we'll see. I mean, I think Boston, at the very least, is the second best team in the East. And I think they'll win the East in the regular season, just as I did last year. I can't see Cleveland caring more than they did last year. Cleveland really didn't get any better. If anything, they'll probably get a little worse. So I have the East, Boston 1, Cleveland 2. This is regular season standings. Washington 3, Toronto 4, Milwaukee 5. After that, you can basically plug in 6 different teams, and I won't argue with you, but I have Miami 6, Charlotte 7, and then Philadelphia 8.
Wow. You didn't say Detroit. They're bringing back the same guys.
Yeah, the same guys that didn't make the playoffs last year and hated each other.
Before we get into this, Nash Equilibrium is a beautiful mind, which is not the theory I was talking about. So I completely botched the beautiful mind theory.
You shouldn't have told me. I wouldn't have known.
I know. You didn't know. I think the Pistons need to sneak in there somehow, some way. Just because they have the same cast of characters, for better or worse. And in this East, I'm going to say worst. And I think they can do it. I agree. I want to jump on the Philly bandwagon, but it is just far too early. If a team like the Minnesota Timberwolves can't make the playoffs, and we're talking about guys with a few years of experience in Towns and Wiggins, and then, of course, Thibodeau, then a team like the Sixers still has a lot of experience needed before they can legitimately contend for a playoff spot. So I'm going to be right there on the bandwagon. I'm going to be chasing it down. I'm going to be trying to ride that bandwagon if I can. It's a Philadelphia 76ers bandwagon, that is. I will be surprised if they make the playoffs. So I'm going to pretty much go with what you said, but replace the Sixers with the Pistons. And I feel pretty good about that. Okay. Because in a state of anarchy and change, the Pistons remain the same, and I kind of know what I'm getting out of them. This is the same reason why I never draft rookies. I know what I'm getting out of the Pistons, and I'm pretty sure they could be the 8 seed in an East that should be down from last year's East.
Yeah, I think it'll be down in the bottom half of the conference. I think the top half is slightly better, if not the same. You know, I think Milwaukee probably gets a little better. I think Toronto is the same, Cleveland's the same, Boston got a little better. So there's 5 teams that you can feel pretty good about locking in. But after that, you know, I mean, the Hawks might be a bottom 5 team in the NBA. The Bulls will probably be a bottom 5 team, and the Pacers. Those are 3 playoff teams from last year that are almost certainly dropping out, and it's hard to see any other result. So I think a team like Miami that almost made the playoffs last year with, you know, Whiteside and Dragic missing time and just injuries all over, that, you know, obviously they overachieved with the group that they had, but if that group stays healthier, I think they can find an equilibrium. And I mean, in the Eastern Conference, I don't know if we're going to see a situation where 35 wins gets you the 8 seed. Wow. But whether we do or not, it's like whether that team is, say, Philly wins 35 games against the 8 seed, or they win 41 games against the 8 seed, it's like what those 6 extra wins that they got are because they're playing worse competition. You know, like I don't know where we're going to see it kind of smooth out. But I mean, there's going to be some brutal, brutal teams in the East and at the bottom of the West too.
Can the Nets make the playoffs?
No, okay. They're not allowed to make the playoffs.
Nets, Magic, Knicks, Bulls, Pacers, Hawks were just riding
the
off.
Knicks are a team I could see, like, but this speaks to how bad some of these other teams are. It's like the Knicks look like a possible 8 seed right now. Until Christmas last year, they were in the mix. If they only wouldn't have had to play the last 55 or so games, they would have been right there.
Yeah.
Orlando's going to be awful. Brooklyn's going to be awful. Brooklyn lost its best player and got D'Angelo Russell. You know, like I don't know that was a win now move by them.
I feel sick for what I'm about to say. Like, I'm pulling over a trash can right now.
Thank you for giving me time to prepare.
Pulling over a trash can right now. I think the Magic could be the 8th seed in the East this coming year. If we're going to talk about change and turnover of rosters, new coaches, all that, Orlando retains the same roster they finished out basically the second half of last season with. They've had some time to gel. You can see this is a common theme with me. I want reliability, some reps. I want, you know, all five guys and some of the bench players to have some reps. They've got a good coach, a coach that all of us considered a top five coach not that long ago in Frank Vogel. And maybe they can figure some things out. Vucevic is solid. Maybe Elfrid Payton, some good veterans off the bench, and Augustine, CJ Watson. Maybe they could do something. I mean, we're talking a very low bar to surpass here, but I do see a roster like this challenging the Knicks, challenging the Heat. It's possible.
No, it is, and that, again, speaks to where the Eastern Conference is right now, because this Orlando team is terrible. But you have Aaron Gordon. If Jonathan Isaac is more ready than we think, you know, Fournier is still good. If Elfrid Payton plays like he did for like that 3-week stretch last year, it's conceivable. I don't think it's crazy.
And Aaron Gordon has been saving up all those jumps he should have been taking over the last few years for this one jump, this maybe Tracy McGrady like jump. You never know.
Yeah, that's in the cards.
Now I'm gonna throw up now.
Yeah, you actually sound like you might.
Yeah.
Let's go to the West. This is where things get interesting, for completely other reasons. Golden State 1. I got Houston 2. Just assuming that Paul and Harden figure it out. San Antonio 3, because they really haven't gotten any better. Oklahoma City 4. Minnesota 5. Denver 6. The Clippers 7. And Portland 8. So that leaves Memphis, Utah, and New Orleans as the three teams that could challenge for, you know, 6, 7, 8.
I hear you. This is hard to do because we don't have this written down.
You don't.
I don't. I refuse to pull up your show notes where this would actually help me out.
This is a shared document.
I think that as I was skeptical of the Timberwolves last year, I'm still a tad bit skeptical. Here's why. The former team that they had didn't show us anything, right? 31 and 51. They added Jimmy Butler. Fantastic player. However, did Jimmy Butler like put the team on his back last year and take them to the playoffs? I don't know. In terms of winning games and like seeing results in the win-loss record, I don't know if I'm ready to anoint Jimmy Butler plus what you would need to get the 5 seed is plus 20 games. Jeff Teague,
also Taj Gibson.
We're saying, are those three guys worth 20 plus 20? Would we even give LeBron James that much if he went to any other team? I don't know.
Yes.
Well, a lot of teams. Okay,
what if Cleveland was
example.
Like plus 35?
A bad example. But that's a lot of games.
The way James and I always talk about this stuff is you have to look at the team's record last year and say, is this the team that they actually are? And I think they underachieved last year. So I don't see, you know, obviously it would in fact be a 20-game jump, but I see it as a 15-game, a 12-game jump, because they shouldn't have won 31 last year. Like, that wasn't a roster that should win 31 games.
Again, I'll say,
they need more.
What from the players on the court tell you that? Because Wiggins, good. Get it. I understand. Karl-Anthony Towns, he's good. I get it. Show me where they've won games.
I just don't see how a team with Towns, Gibson, Wiggins, Butler, Teague, and Jang as its top six doesn't make the playoffs.
Now, I didn't say playoffs because that would only mean a 10 game jump, and I'm willing to go there. But you and a lot of other people saying 4-5 with Minnesota, 4-5, which is like you're rating them higher than you did coming into last year.
Yes.
And they did. I mean,
They added Jimmy Butler.
Aren't you guys snake bitten?
They added an all NBA player.
Aren't you snake bitten by your terrible projections from last year?
I know. Last year, I did not predict them to make the playoffs. So
I'm
talking
about Earth. You know, the rest of Earth.
I don't speak
with their
Earth.
Terrible Timberwolves projections. I'm just saying, like, aren't you a little bit snake bitten? Earth, come on.
I mean, we'll wait on the response from Earth. But who do you put above them then?
Warriors, Spurs, Rockets,
Yes.
Thunder, Trailblazers, Nuggets. Then I would say the Timberwolves. And where am I at? Do I need one more playoff team? The Clippers.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
The Clippers. So I'm saying that the Timberwolves sneak in there in a similar fashion that the Grizzlies did this year, where, you know, the last 2 weeks of the season, it's up in the air, but they kind of clinch with still 4 or 5 games left.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. I mean, Oklahoma City was a playoff
you
team.
You mean where I'm coming from, the fact that the Timberwolves were 31-51
yeah.
last year?
Well, no, I mean, I think you're saying, like, Oklahoma City was, what were they, the 6?
They were the 6 7? Seed, yep.
And so they go from being a playoff team already, adding Paul George. So playoff team getting better.
I have them getting better by like 4 or 5 games.
Yeah, and you're saying like there was already such a gap between OKC and Minnesota last
yes.
year that the addition of Paul George, even though Minnesota got better.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's an argument. I think Minnesota is a playoff team though, right? Can we agree with that?
Yes, I got them as a 7. I'll probably have them as, there's still a lot to be decided,
yeah.
but probably a 7 seed.
Well, let's put it this way. So Oklahoma City 4, Minnesota 5, that's my list. You put the Clippers ahead?
No, Clippers would be fighting for that 8 seed. I would put the Trailblazers and Nuggets ahead of the Timberwolves. So there's our jumping off
Nuggets
point.
Are going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't be shocking if the Nuggets were in that 3-4 range.
Okay,
it would be there's surprising,
no,
but it wouldn't be shocking.
There's no need to make declarations like that.
It's not a declaration. I just said it would just be a surprise. But I think if everything breaks right, I mean, they were a really good team last year, and now you're adding Paul Millsap. They have a lot of guards. They need a point guard. That's the thing. You can only go. So you can't. You're not going to be the 3 seed if Emmanuel Mudiay is playing 25 minutes a game.
Everybody says that, but he wasn't playing much at the end of last year. It's going to be Jamal Murray. It's going to be Jameer Nelson. So. Notable teams that are outside for me, Pelicans is somebody you had in.
Pelicans would be the 4 in the East. I think they're
no,
better. They're better
not,
than Milwaukee.
Everybody keeps saying, all right, I obviously have a problem with the way we're talking about projected playoff rankings because you're just echoing what a lot of other people are saying. And not to say you don't have original thought, but a lot of people are saying this too. Like, Pelicans, 4 in the East. They're making the playoffs in the West.
Oh, it's no, they're not making the playoffs in the West. I'm just saying they'd be the 4 in the East.
Okay.
They're not making it in the West.
Well, yeah, that sucks for them. But, I mean, I think the Pelicans would be lucky to improve on their record that they had this year of 34-48.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it was Tom Haberstroh who said, I don't even remember where he said this, that teams like Boston are going to be keeping a close eye on that situation, and DeMarcus Cousins basically being an expiring, and if they come out of the gates, like New Orleans every year, it feels like starts the season like 0-15.
Yeah.
And if they come out and they're sitting at 5-12, you know, in early December, I think the calls are going to start coming in, because the way that this Western Conference is going to go, you're not just going to be able to make up games like that.
So here's a quick way, just to recap. Compared to the teams in the West that made the playoffs last year, you still think the Clippers, who were a 4 seed last year, are still going to make the playoffs next year?
Wait, I'm sorry. Can you rephrase that?
Are the Clippers going to make the playoffs this coming year?
I think so. I have them as a 7. I think, you know, losing Paul is huge, and we're going to see. We haven't really seen this group without him,
mm-hmm.
so that could be disastrous. Who knows? But they bring in Teodosic. You still have Patrick Beverley, who I think is really good. If Blake's healthy, they make it. If Blake's not healthy, they're out.
I'll put them
as
the 8. Jazz, we both have falling out.
Yeah. And we just went on about how Gordon Hayward might not even be that good, and they're going to bring back pretty much everybody else, and they have Rubio. But, I mean, what it just comes down to, if you compare them head-to-head, it's like, I like Portland better. I like the Clippers better. I like Denver's roster better, then all of a sudden you're up back into the top 4 and 5 teams, and we know Utah's not, you know, if anything, Utah's getting the 7 or the 8.
Rodney Hood will have to have an amazing season for them to make the playoffs, and I don't think there's any other way around him having an amazing season.
Yeah.
So Thunder you have making it, Grizzlies you have making it still as well. And
no,
then,
I don't. I have Memphis at 9.
You do? Wow, that would be something. Trailblazers you have out as well? or making?
I have them as the 8.
Okay. So not a lot of turnover here based on what you're projecting. And I think that's fair. I think people are going to overreact to all these roster moves and, you know, go crazy and project the Nuggets to be the 3 seed. But when in reality, when we look at last year's playoff teams compared to this coming year's, it's just going to be a couple changes. I mean, that's what it is from year to year every time anyways.
Right. Well, the teams that were at the center of these moves were mostly playoff teams already. You know, the Clippers, Oklahoma City, Houston, Golden State. You know, these teams were already, you know, 3-4 of the top 5 or 6 teams in the conference last year. So it was kind of a rich get richer or a rich shake up their core type of situation. You know, it's not like Sacramento went out and got Chris Paul and James Harden. You know, Houston just got Chris Paul. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be the regular season should at least be more fun, right?
The regular season should definitely be more fun because the best part is that all 4 of these Western Conference teams play each other 4 times. They only have to dip across basically the continental divide, if you will, twice. One thing I do want to ask you, just real quick, because I need you to just keep me sane here, is Ty Lawson was brought on to the Houston Rockets, right, with James Harden.
Like a while back?
Not that long ago, just last year.
I'm just saying, like, he didn't sign there in the last hour.
No, a while back, like last year, 2 years ago, right? And what happened was Ty Lawson was rendered useless to the bench, and he just, you know, it just wasn't a good fit. Right?
Don't say it.
How similar is that situation to this Chris Paul situation?
Not very.
Are you okay?
Chris Paul is not Ty Lawson.
I know, but
0 DUIs.
I'm aware of that, but Ty Lawson was one of the better point guards in the league for a while back in his Denver days. I know he's had some troubles, but he was a very, very good point guard coming over to play with a ball dominant James Harden. We're talking about an extremely good Chris Paul coming over to play with a ball dominant James Harden. I think there should be more parallels drawn here than have been made already.
No? I don't think so. I think in some ways Houston clearing out its guard depth is going to help because they're going to rely a ton on Chris Paul and James Harden, which if they stay healthy is great. And we're going to see, I don't think they're going to be on the floor together quite as much as people expect. I think that, I mean, obviously they're going to start together and they're going to close together. But if you're Houston, you know, you have arguably the 2 best pick and roll creators and passers at the point guard position in the NBA, and two of the best ever, honestly, if we want to go by the season that Harden had last year and Chris Paul's entire body of work. You want to stagger those guys, right? I think as much as you can. Like the way if I'm Mike D'Antoni, I have in my mind, I'm like, all right, I have point guard 1 and point guard 1A at my disposal. One of these guys should be handling the ball at all times.
I'm a terrible person to ask because I'm jaded of how the Thunder have handled their guys in the past, where for whatever reason, back when Durant and Westbrook were together, they always like took breaks together. It just made no sense.
Yeah.
And even this past year, you know, like Westbrook's minutes probably should have been staggered a little bit differently than they were. And I don't know. I don't know if there's like hot and cold zones or whatever they talk about, like where a player just needs to rest that long. Because there was a lot of times where you said, like, Russell just needs to play the whole game. We know he can, but he was in that red zone where athletic trainers, when they run their analytics, they just say he's actually more efficient if you give him a longer break. And so it makes sense. And I wonder if that, you know, that kind of thinking will come in the way, you know, as a Thunder fan, I've been jaded from just quote-unquote staggering minutes. I don't even know it's a real thing because I've never seen it in action.
Yeah, that is true. The Thunder were always really bizarre about that. But I mean, again, they're going to play together. I'm not trying to say that they're just going to like make Chris Paul the backup point guard.
You're right, though.
Don't have really any other options.
It makes sense for one of those guys to always be on the court every single game.
Yeah, because looking at their guard depth right now, if those guys are both off the court, who is handling the ball? Is it Eric Gordon? Is it Bobby Brown? Those are the 2 options.
Trevor Ariza and PJ Tucker.
Yeah,
might be,
I mean, they'll sign
the
someone.
Ball up court.
They'll bring in their version of Jose Calderon or whoever it might be, a Jameer Nelson type, and that'll be fine. But I think when you can have the option of Harden or Chris Paul handling the ball, you just do it that way. Anything else you want to touch on? We got the Kings. Otto Porter, we're still up in the air on, but I mean, he's going back to Washington. Robertson, 3 for 30 seems like a really good deal.
It is a really good deal for one of the best declared by Kevin Durant, who's played with him and against some perimeter defenders in the league. Yeah. Keep in mind, he's one of the worst shooters in the league from all areas of the court.
He just seemed like one of those guys who was going to get way too much money.
And,
I saw that figure, and I was like, geez, that seems like he's taking a discount.
I was ready for him to move on and see what the Thunder could be without the mental block of him needing to be on the court. Because I understand it, right? You preach defense, you preach it. Day in, day out, in practice, games, scrimmages, he's doing exactly what the coach wants. He's a great coach guy. But should he actually be on the court during important games? I don't know. And so I was kind of excited. I was definitely excited just to see the Thunder not even have to think of him as a possibility, because more often than not, they sided with playing him a bunch of minutes, and I don't know that that's operating efficiently.
Last year, they didn't have much choice. You know, it was like, who is it going to be, him or McDermott? And in that scenario, it's just opposite. Like, McDermott gives you the offense, but zero defense. Robertson gives you the defense, but zero offense. It's hard. It's really, really hard to compete with good teams like Houston and eventually Golden State if you get that far, when one of the guys on the court is just a complete non-factor on either end. And I think it's easier to get away with if that guy's a really good defender than like a Kyle Korver type, right? Because at least he gives you something that no one else in your roster can give you on the defensive end.
Well,
you're just playing 4-on-5 for half the game.
Yeah. Well, guys like McDermott and Kyle Korver are still dependent on the offensive. They're really good offensive players, but they're still dependent on somebody else to create for them. And so if you talk about Andre Roberson on the defensive side, like, he doesn't need anybody's help in the pick and roll. He's not like super good at pick and roll defense where, you know, there's another player involved somehow. He's just very good at locking down guys on the perimeter. So I don't know. I was enticed by the idea of him not being an option, even though they didn't really have many other options last year.
The issue with him is he got worse on offense. Like, he closed 2015-16 with some encouraging games. He shot 31% from three, which for him is great. And then he comes out and shoots 24% from three last year. And the free throw shooting, too. Like, that's a really bad sign of, like, this guy is, like, severely, severely broke as a shooter if you're shooting 42% from the free throw line. Well, he was at, like, what were his free throw numbers in the playoffs? 3 of 21. That's unbelievably bad for any player, let alone a wing.
Well, the sad part here is it's all mental. Because if you go look at all his shot attempts, it's not in traffic, he's not being double teamed, he's not forcing the issue. All his shot attempts come when he is wide open, to the point where everybody in the whole arena has their eyes on you.
He shot 38% from three the second year of college.
It's from three?
From three.
Yeah, that's why it's mental. It's totally mental. Because the way he's shooting it puts so much pressure on him mentally. It's just like there's almost no other player in the league where all his shot attempts come from wide open. And that's almost a bad thing because it's turned for the worse with him, where there's just this mental block that he cannot get over. It's so bad. Everybody in the arena, and him most importantly, knows that the shot is not going to fall.
It got pretty bad at the end of that playoff series. I wouldn't say I felt bad for him, but it was a lot of sad.
It is.
I mean, you just knew. Like, they kept sending him to the line, and it was like, just give him a break, man. This is not fair.
And that's where, like, Hack-a-DeAndre works. That works.
Yeah,
in practice.
It works when it's your 7'1", 300-pound center. Like, you can't be hacking your starting three. Like, that's a big issue. He's the only guy in the history of the position that's been hacked, hasn't he? Did they ever do that to Tony Allen?
I don't know. Because
they kind of did it to LeBron.
But kind of. But you know what, Tony Allen, like, he had that gene where he actually rose to the occasion. Like, he when that spotlight was actually, like, truly on him, he kind of did rise to the occasion. But guess what, Thunder fans, we got three more years of that. Three more years at $10 million per year.
That's not a bad price. All things
considered.
It's
not a bad price.
At least you're not overpaying for terrible free throw shooting.
That would be something to smirk at.
Last thing, Dion Waiters, back in Miami. I was hoping we'd get a Players Tribune article after his Pulitzer Prize-worthy article earlier in the year. This seems like maybe a little bit of an overpay, but he was really good. I mean, there's no two ways about it. For the, 60 games that he played last year, he was the second best player on that team, probably. And, well, go ahead.
Well, we've talked about late bloomers on this podcast, Tracy McGrady. Who was the other one? Like, maybe relating him to
Johnny O'Brien.
Or Johnny O'Brien, yeah, sure. He's still only 25 years old. And you do wonder, you know, he was at Cleveland, not a good fit, maybe. Oklahoma City, played with, you know, Russell and Kevin Durant, wasn't able to shine. Now maybe he's finally getting into a system where he can shine, and I think Miami's welcoming him back with open arms if he can give exactly what he did for them last year. I mean, he was part of that amazing run they went on with a bunch of nobodies. I mean, he was a star of a cast of nobodies, and he was actually putting them on his back and taking them to the promised land. And, well, not quite, but can you make the argument that he almost won Eric Spoelstra Coach of the Year? Like, he might be the reason.
He was hurt for a lot of that.
I know he only played 46 games, but like, he played a major role in Eric Spoelstra getting some Coach of the Year buzz.
Maybe in that people gave him extra credit because he coached Dion Waiters success.
I'm not joking here. That's an actual thing. That's what I'm saying.
Well, he's just the next in like a long line of guys that have kind of followed this J.R. Smith, JaVale McGee, like redemption path, you know, where it seemed like in the past guys like this would just keep spiraling down and down and down. And, you know, for whatever reason, we've seen a couple stories like this. So, yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing for Miami is like, Dion Waiters was not option one or two or three or four for them, but they have a bunch of cap space. They need to spend it on somebody, and he just kind of happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Good for him. It's as simple as that, huh?
Yeah, it really is. I think we just got to wait that out. Some team will come calling. Are you restricted this summer?
Dion?
No, you. Your contract.
Oh, me. Well, that's the thing. I feel confident that I could knock down a couple more open looks than Andre Roberson could.
Well, you have not been at Roto Hoops in a very long time. To your credit, neither have I. Mm-hmm. But you haven't been there longer. Are you fully recovered from that? Was it an ankle injury?
Yeah, it was a foot thing. I don't know what happened. I am fully recovered. I just have new things going on basketball nights. Mm. Yeah. Mentally, I don't know, because I really haven't got out there since that major foot injury.
Did we ever get a diagnosis? Did you visit Dr. James?
Never went
Anders?
To the doctor, but it definitely sprained something. Had the good old bruise all the way up the length of the foot. Like, you know, anybody that's sprained their ankle knows that like slender bruising that happens along the left.
Anyone who's an
foot.
Athlete like us knows.
Right. Hey, put me in the Players Tribune. I'll talk about my foot injury.
Yeah, you can talk about how you beat a sprained ankle.